This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanisan and Noel Lim. It is 6 o'clock in the morning, Wednesday the 24th of February, and we're midway through yet another week. Guys, how are we today, Noel?
I'm good. It's midweek, another two more days to the weekend.
And you know what happens then? We end the second month of 2021.
Yeah, wow. I had that realization because it's only 28 days in February, right? Which means that Monday is March. Where did the time go?
Yep. Yes, all those questions and more. We are not covering that on The Morning Run, however.
We're not. But you know what? It is relevant to quite a lot of parents who quite suddenly will see March 1st have schools reopened for their kids. And I think still a lot of questions and concerns surrounding that. So we spoke about that yesterday with Datin Nur Azimah of the Parent Action Group for Education. So if you're interested, do check it out on the BFM app or on Spotify. But today, we do have lots of interesting things lined up. Noel, what are we talking about later on at about 6:30?
Well, it is about the Facebook and Australia saga and something about Biden's nominee and also Capitol Hill security officials pointing fingers and also maybe something on the US sanctions against Russia.
Fantastic. A fascinating time at 6:30 as always.
Sound fascinated.
I'm always fascinated. I'm always interested by all these things. Towards the end of the hour, of course, local papers and portals will take a look at what and inform you of what's happening on the ground. But at about 6:15, in about 10-15 minutes, we're going to be talking about making diamonds out of thin air and the possible implications for the world.
Interesting stuff. And if you want to weigh in on these conversations, remember you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, though, we are taking a look back at the GameStop disaster and asking what might be needed to stop another one from happening. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Revolution Rock by The Clash, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. So this morning, the first article that we are looking at today is from Fast Company. It's quite an interesting one, taking a look back at last week's GameStop hearing on Capitol Hill. Now, it's written by this fellow called Bradley Tusk. He's a venture capitalist, writer, philanthropist, political strategist, and he is of the opinion that really the entire hearing was focused on the wrong culprit. So they put Robinhood, Reddit, and Twitter all under the spotlight. But he's of the opinion that actually it should be regulators that should be held accountable for kind of what happened with GameStop.
Yeah, I think the premise of his article is essentially that when it comes to new technologies and the rapidly changing world that we're living in, regulators need to keep up with the changing times, right? They need to, and especially from a government's point of view, don't you want to be the bedrock of new technologies? Don't you want to guide that forward instead of having these technologies become such a big issue later on and then having to deal with it retrospectively? Can you be proactive in the way you not deal with, but grow with technology? Because it's not the government's job to think about future innovation, and it's not the innovator's job to think about regulations. The innovator looks at the gaps in regulations and then taps into that, and then they grow. But you know, it can't be like, oh, let the innovator grow to a certain size, and then we like, oh, wait, you're too big.
Or now, wait until something, you know, catastrophic goes wrong, and then be like, oh, yes, we needed regulation.
Yeah, and you know, and the title of the article is How to Prevent the Next GameStop Disaster. It's not talking about how to prevent the next GameStop stock rally and crash. It's talking about how to basically look forward and how to prevent the next miscommunication and drama that comes out of when regulators don't understand the market dynamics the market dynamics at play currently, whether it's electric vehicles, whether it's things like Airbnb, Uber. These are all things that require regulation on both sides, right? There are multiple stakeholders that need to be taken care of. And love it or hate it, the regulator, that's the regulator's job to step in and watch out.
So the job primarily of a regulator is to ensure the smooth functioning of the markets, capital markets in this case, and also to watch out for anything that may pose a systemic risk problem. So that's their first and foremost task. But obviously, regulation, as we know, has a track record of falling behind innovation. So, but now technology has become such a prominent piece in the capital markets, right? And, you know, people are just hooking onto all these social media platforms to get information and to trade on it. So there's no more excuse. The regulators just might have to consider either broadening their scope of regulation. For example, Reddit and Twitter are probably outside their scope of purview. But then how then can they, you know, nudge them to be part of, you know, a responsible player in the ecosystem, right? For example, can they compel Reddit, Twitter, or even as well as Robinhood that comes under them to have disclaimers, right? You know, for when people post something on Reddit, should there be some sort of disclaimer to say, you know, like, you know, something along the lines, beware of what you're posting, you know, be, you know, take responsibility of what you're posting or something like that. Yeah. And also another point here is about Robinhood, right? So some of Robinhood's practices, you know, they nudge investors along the thing to get them to buy more stocks, right? You know, like, for example, you buy your first purchase and then they do a big...
Every purchase, actually, the confetti comes out.
Yeah, yeah, they do a big, you know, a big party about it, right? Oh, hey, you bought your first stock or something, or you bought a stock. So, you know, looking at these kind of nudging practices, is that healthy, you know? Yeah, I think then regulators just have to buck up on that.
I mean, if we're starting to talk about nudging practices, we can talk about the food industry as well. We can talk about the placement of groceries in the grocery aisle. The things that are eye level with you are not necessarily the healthiest things. There's no secret. There's no things like sugars and snacks are all left in the aisle closer to the cashier because these nudge you. Behavioral science has been tapped into for generations into making us spend more money. Lazada, Alibaba, all of them, everyone, Amazon, making it easier for us to click one button and spend. So nudging practices should be something that is looked into. But how do it's down to the regulators, right? Like, we want a free market society, and we also want to create a mature society, a buyer beware situation, right? You have to be careful. I think it was the Ministry of Domestic Trade yesterday, Dato Sri Nathalingi, who said that, Alexander Nathalingi, who said that they're starting to see more complaints of fraud online because of people basically either selling things that aren't exactly what they were saying, or price hiking, or variations in prices day to day. So these are all the things that come with the new technologies that we're seeing and the digital world. So I don't know, can regulators really catch up, or do we have to educate society as a whole that you need to be careful online? It's everything and nothing at the same time, you know?
I think it's a combination of both, because education of the public is nevertheless important. You know, being aware of nudging practices, being aware of things like, you know, media literacy, for example, and the spin that is placed on articles, helps you become a more independent and aware consumer. But when it comes to governments and regulators as well, there is always a sense of inertia that needs to be overcome, because, you know, governments have layers and layers of bureaucracy. And when it comes to regulating, okay, the food industry, regulating automated vehicles, that's one thing. But, you know, a few years ago, I remember, every year there's this massive kind of cybersecurity conference that's held in the US. And, the common theme of the articles that came out of it was that, you know, governments were woefully unprepared to be dealing with what cyber criminals were coming up with almost on a daily basis. So that's why we saw, you know, rises in the instances of DDoS attacks on government websites. And because these for criminals, I guess, similar in this instance, and I guess only in this instance to entrepreneurs, innovation is the name of the game. You have to. I'm not saying entrepreneurs are criminals. I'm just saying that there is a commonality here that you are looking for loopholes deliberately. And if the governments or the regulators are too slow to close those loopholes, then, you know, things can really blow up in their faces.
Lin-Mark, the correct term is gaps in the market. Yes. That's the term we like to use. And also, the biggest question, no, the accurate term. All right, all said and done. We expect a lot and we want a lot from regulators. The big question is, are they being funded well enough? And are they paid well enough to do their jobs? And this is a question we can ask about government service overall, teachers, policemen, everyone. There are gaps in their salary brackets, in their funding, whether they're compensated well for the work that we want them to do. It really does come back always down to the bottom line.
Let us know what you think about this. You can WhatsApp us at 01878988899 or you can tweet us over at BFM Radio. We are heading into some messages right now and then we're taking a look at this story with diamonds being created out of thin air. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Knock on Wood by Eddie Floyd. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanizan and Noel Lim. So this morning, we are turning our attention to a very interesting story about diamonds, which, you know, as they say, are forever. But it appears that diamonds no longer take forever to make because, you know, historically or typically, they are formed, you know, deep beneath the Earth's crust. And then, you know, then they're thrust hundreds of kilometers into the air by volcanic eruptions before they have to be processed. And it's a very time-consuming and energy-consuming process to produce a cut diamond. But it appears that there are now technology has developed to the point where diamonds can be made out of thin air. So lab-grown diamonds are seeing a surge in popularity.
Yes, I'm looking at some of these articles here, right? And it says apparently 70% of millennials will consider buying a lab-grown alternative, a lab diamond. And Meghan Markle, our princess, is she a princess? Anyway.
Not technically our princess.
Yes, okay. Yeah, not ours.
The collective world's princess, right? The symbolic, not the actual one. We don't care if they're actually royals, but I think because of the way they've stood against the royalty and moved away, she's a new modern day princess all the right ways.
The inheritor of the people's princess title.
Yes,
is
the
it?
People's princess.
Yeah, so in sync with that, she wore a lab diamond too. And so they're apparently cheaper, or maybe there's probably some quite expensive variety and more environmentally friendly. Mm-hmm. As we know, you know, the diamond companies sometimes they have a bit of a patchy record when it comes to human rights and environmental records. But apparently, it's not compulsory for them to comply or to disclose. So, and I think there's this organization, Human Rights Watch, have said that some of these diamond companies have fallen short of international standards. They don't identify their mines of origin, and we know that sometimes some child labor practices do take place in some of these mines.
I think also it's important to know whenever new synthetic types of things come out, especially when it comes to, yes, the making of it may be better, but what are the upstream, downstream, the background things that go into making that diamond that could be environmentally detrimental, right? Does it really, on a net basis, is it really a positive thing for the environment? And really comes down to what kind of energy sources these labs are using, right? It's going to come down to that. So the lab that the FT is interviewing says they use hydropower, but these labs are not compelled to disclose where they are getting their power sources from. So I guess you got to look at the country's power sources. And if you take a look at some of the numbers here, the FT reports that last year, 50 to 60% of the world's lab-grown diamonds were made in China. And that's according to a Bain report. And China's predominant source of energy is coal. So net, positive, negative, we don't know. Is it a positive? Is it a move in the right direction? Possibly, quite possibly, because carbon neutral aside, what you're doing is you're no longer digging giant holes in the ground to mine these resources. You're not using labor that is questionable to say the least, and you're not deforesting a bunch of areas as well, right? But miners aren't just sitting back. Some of the big ones are saying, hey, listen, look at all the things that we're doing. We're declaring, because they're public listed companies, right? And they want to be ESG, more ESG compliant and all of that. They're saying, hey, look at all the things we're doing. We're certified this and we are injecting carbon into the mines that we're not using, and we are making sure that we use renewable power. So it's competition in the industry, which is only going to, hopefully, cross fingers, drive all this forward.
But the problem is with the existing mining, the existing kind of diamond mining industry, for for example, is that their supply is unfortunately finite, because a lot of gemstone mines get depleted over time because we consume them at a much higher, much faster rate than these gemstones take to form over millennia. So, you know, when it comes to these production of lab-grown diamonds, I think it was Bain Capital that came out to say that lab-grown diamonds, the production of which has risen from 2 million carats in 2018 to between 6 to 7 million carats last year. And that compares with the mining production, though, of 111 million carats. So still a bit of a drop in the ocean. But it depends on whether or not this, you know, pretty exponential trajectory will continue. And this also has helped push down prices as a whole. So a polished 1 carat lab-grown stone is roughly a third cheaper than a polished mine diamond. So, you know, it's you can see where the attraction may be, particularly for millennials, as you noted, Noel, and just also for those who are a little bit, perhaps a little bit more conscious of where it is their gemstones are coming from.
Yeah, so I think it's an environmental concern and also maybe a price concern as well. I mean, things are getting more expensive these days, right? So, and also I think there's some novelty factor here, wearing synthetic diamonds. So De Beers is also into synthetic diamonds. So I guess they're also hedging their risk. But no, this is not just about diamonds. It's really about that ESG trend, you know, how material science is going to help evolve. What's the implication of mining industry? So we're going to have like synthetic gold, maybe synthetic silver as well.
But when it comes to all these synthetic things, I'm skeptical over what it's made of, right? End of the day, and the other effects they could have. EV vehicles are great. Oh, we're going to use a battery, no fossil fuels. Hey, building those batteries, those lithium ion batteries, requires a lot of mining, and that's limited as well. So there are always going to be implications and consequences. Nothing is pure good, you know, end of the day. It's about whether at this time we need to overcorrect to those particular gaps.
But we know one thing, diamonds are forever, synthetic or otherwise.
Well, let us know what you think about that then. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We're about to head into the 6:30 news bulletin now, and to take you there is Queen with A Kind of Magic, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Fleetwood Mac with You Make Loving Fun, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. It is 6:39 a.m. Wednesday, the 24th of February, and right now we are turning our attention to what's been happening on the international stage. And the saga over the past week or so has been to do with Facebook in Australia. So now the latest news is that Facebook has backed down from its news blackout in Australia after the government there agreed to amend legislation that was forcing both Facebook and Google to pay local publishers for content.
Yeah, this would have been the world's first legislation of this kind. And the Facebook, in response, so initially we had two responses. Google was working with commercial deals and with publishers. Facebook turned off news sharing in Australia altogether in, I guess, protest or opposition to the law. It seems like both the government and Facebook have come to a kind of consensus, as the government said on yesterday, I think, it would take into account commercial deals that Google and Facebook reach with news companies before they decide whether they are subject to the law. Now, the legislation is expected to pass Parliament this week. And really, what this has done is it has made Australia the testing ground for regulation when it comes to the big tech companies. Particularly in this arena, it's about publishers and social media sharing and all of that. And what this could do, the ripple effects to other countries around the world. In fact, this Bloomberg article notes that Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said that he's been fielding queries from several world leaders about the Facebook clash, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Canadian leader Justin Trudeau, French President Emmanuel Macron, and UK's Boris Johnson. So everyone's kind of being like, hey, Scott, how are you handling this? Because we're also looking at different ways to manage this situation. It's become like a little bit of a proxy battle. And you're seeing these proxy battles happen everywhere. In California, you had the Prop 21 legislation or law that was being taken to the polls that regarded Uber. There was a court battle in London that also has implications for Uber and how to classify employees. You're seeing all this happening right now because regulations have not kept up with the times.
Yeah, so people are questioning who actually won in this battle. I think, you know, both are winners, Australian government and the news sites as well as Facebook, because now Australia will offer four amendments, and one of them will include a change to the proposed mandatory arbitration mechanism used when the tech giants cannot reach a fair deal with the publishers. So basically what Facebook said, that the government has clarified that they retain the ability to decide if news can appear on Facebook. So they won't be automatically be subjected to a forced negotiation. So I think it's fair. So Facebook and news sites have some time to decide, and Facebook can decide, okay, if they don't like this deal, they won't put the news site on their platform. But if the deal is, but if they're okay with it, they will still put the news site on Facebook.
Yeah, I still have concerns though, because there are differences between companies like News Corp with giant publications like the Wall Street Journal and a few publications they have in Australia and the UK for that matter, and their ability to use their leverage and negotiating power at the, well, the negotiation table versus smaller publications who could be bullied into certain terms that may not be necessarily fair value to what they have. But I guess when it comes to social media, it really is about how shareable and how clickable your publication is, right? And how it resonates with the audience in that particular country. Yeah, so I mean, one-on-one negotiations are great for those with leverage, but that's why we have unions in general, right? Because sometimes you have to protect the little guy from being essentially exploited in a lot of situations.
So perhaps we'll see the rise of more coalitions of smaller news companies then in order to bank
coalition
on that
of Australian publications,
something like that. We'll have to wait and see how this story develops. But turning our attention also over to the U.S., President Joe Biden has come out with his nominee to be Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's number two. And this has indicated that the U.S. is open to using a Trump-era investment ban in order to punish Beijing for violating international trade rules. So this nominee for Deputy Treasury Secretary, his name is Wally Adeyemo, and he said during his Senate confirmation hearing that it's critical that the U.S. use Treasury's tools to hold China accountable for actions they take that are not consistent with international law.
Yeah, so some background information on Adeyemo, 39 years old, a former senior advisor asset manager BlackRock. So he would be the first Black Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. So quite an achievement here. And I think it's in line with Biden's commitment to ensure more diversity in his cabinet. And so I think what he's saying, that his immediate priority is to ensure U.S. prosperity during this COVID-19 pandemic, with a more focus on low-income communities and people of color. But yes, this thing about China, he seems to be taking of quite a hardline stance here, and they want to use Treasury Department tools to protect their citizens and to ensure fair economic practices between China and US.
Yeah, I think basically the statement here is that we're not cutting these tools in the box, right? We're not going to put them away necessarily. We're going to keep them on hand in case we need to use them. And we're not afraid to use these tools should they need to be employed because of whatever reasons they want to use them for. But he did indicate that and state that while the U.S. is open to taking unilateral action, it's always best, in quotes there, to pursue multilateral solutions to demonstrate that China will be isolated if they violate the rules of the road. End of the day, China is also, this is basically the difference between getting a coalition together and one-on-one negotiations, right? And the U.S. and China are two big powerhouses in the globe. So it'll be interesting to see how they duke it out. But I wonder how they will be coordinating with the State Department, right? So whether Antony Blinken and Janet Yellen will be talking about how to approach the containment strategies when it comes to China's influence.
Because this is what's most notable, right? The fact is that the Treasury Department has historically separated the economics and security of certain issues, but now it looks like they may be looking at it in a more holistic fashion. So what's that going to mean for US-China relations? Well, let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got some messages for you and then some papers and portals from our own local outlets. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, that was Franz Ferdinand with Take Me Out, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. So we have the local papers and portals open in front of us now this morning. So what do we have here? The Star's headline front page is preparing for reopening of school, because that's happening on Monday next week, admittedly with not that much notice. So excited seven-year-olds going to school for the first time, can't wait for the adventure to begin. That's the kind of paragraph that we have on the front page. Noel, you're holding the NST. What's of interest there?
Well, of interest is the vaccination process. I'm assuming most people rush to register themselves on MySejahtera.
Have you registered yourself?
Yes, of course I did. But I think it will be the next phase or sometime soon. Mm. Anyway, the article basically here is about Dato' Sri Dr. Adam Baba, our health minister, briefing the press about the five stages that one has to go through in order to get vaccinated. Five stations. So the first is that they will screen you for symptoms and temperature check. And then the second stage is to get counselling and immunisation consent. And the immunisation consent at the third stage. And then at the fourth station, you'll get the jab finally. And then in the fifth station, the final station, you will have to wait because they want to monitor your conditions for 15 to 30 minutes. I think just including the queuing up process, this sounds like a whole day affair to just get immunised.
Yeah, but at least they've got the structure out, right? At least they're laying it out clear there. And speaking of that, on the Malay Mail, I opened up the story on speaking of immunizations, the National COVID-19 Immunization Program is expected, hopefully, to be completed by the end of the year, ahead of its projected completion date in February. And this was a statement from the program's coordinating minister, who is also the Minister of Science, Technology and Innovation, Kari Jamaluddin. And he said he was confident based on the level of efficacy and professionalism of the MOH. And the vaccinations rollout starts today, right, with the Prime Minister, or is it tomorrow? And we will see that start the rollout.
It is today. Director General.
Correct. 24th of February is today. Correct. I wasn't sure whether today was Wednesday or not. But yes, so it kicks off today, which was 2 days earlier than it was supposed to start. And with the SOPs in place, I think the communication has been very forthcoming with all of this. They've been talking to enough media outlets, I think, to get the information across. So let's see. Let's hope we can get this out, because I think a lot of hopes are being pinned on the ability to get the vaccine rollout smoothly and procure enough supplies to get all of this done.
Yes, so the Star front page as well has a little panel on the bottom with the vaccination rollout. And this is talking about the batch of 55,000 teachers who are categorized as high risk. They will be among those receiving the COVID-19 vaccination in the first phase of the program before school reopens. So by the end of this week. So it's good to see that teachers are being considered frontliners at this time, particularly on the back of the news that schools are going to be reopening on March 1st. So I'm also taking a look at the Malay Mail, where they have comments from Khairi Jamaluddin, the Science, Technology and Innovation Minister, saying that actually this national COVID-19 immunization program is expected to be completed before the end of this year. So this is a bit sooner than the projected completion date, which was originally in February of next year. So I guess that is optimistic news, that perhaps we may be able to get everyone vaccinated soon, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, and some other big news I think you may have heard yesterday was in the morning we had the KL High Court had granted an interim stay against the Immigration Department's plan to deport 1,200 Myanmar nationals. And the stay was supposed to go up until this morning at 10 a.m. But it seems that yesterday evening that the Immigration Department went ahead with the deportation. So this is a story we're going to have to really pay attention to, because what happened essentially is going to be the question here. Mm-hmm. And whether there will be, I guess, consequences or actions taken against some kind of communication about what happened yesterday evening.
Yeah, so just another piece of news here by NSD. It's on page 8. It might seem like a small news, but I just want to kind of give recognition to this. The Gua Kepa Archaeological Gallery in Kepala Batas has been listed as a National Heritage Site under the National Heritage Act 2005. And this gallery actually contains or it carries the prehistoric human skeleton believed to be at least 5,000 years old. And, you know, so this is, I mean, quite a big find. It's a bit unfortunate. I think our society don't value these things, you know, give it much value. But I think it's just so important because I don't think in this part of the region, we are the only ones who have found, you know, such old skeletons, such ancient skeletons.
Yeah. Speaking of, no, not speaking of anything like that. But anyway, another piece of news I see here that's caught my attention, Lejikini, is that police have opened an investigation paper against DAP Secretary General Lim Guan Eng over a statement issued by Pakatan Harapan on the emergency declaration last month. And lawyer RSN Raya said the police contacted Lim Guan Eng yesterday to inform him of the investigation. So just another thing that we're seeing play out amongst all this, amongst the news following the emergency declaration, but a month later seems quite a distance, I think. But we'll be paying attention to seeing how this plays out.
All right, and that is all of the local news that we have for you this morning because we're about to head into the 7 o'clock bulletin. But don't go away. After that, we're bringing you more business news and analysis. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.